the 7 AA meeting. My name's Tim R., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NABAZOOM, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women on Zoom tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Paul O. was here long before I hit AA. I saw him my very beginning at NABA. He's a regular of the 7:30 early morning study group, active in all the meetings, really, I guess. I see him frequently. And at the Atlanta Men's Workshop, he's always active there. And when you see him there, he is a one happy camper. He spreads a lot of joy everywhere he goes. So I'm real glad to introduce Paul O.
Thank you, Tim. And thank you to everyone for being here. I've told my story before. This is my first Zoom thing. Let's see. Okay. Now I'm unmuted. So this is my first time not using Zoom, but telling my story on Zoom. And I'm really grateful to be here. And thank you, Tim, for asking me to do this. It always helps me. It's like my sponsor used to tell me and baffle me. You're doing me much good than I'm doing you, he would tell me. And so I don't know how much good I'm going to do for anybody, but like, the reading Tim did, this will be good for me. I always remind myself a couple of things before I start. One of them is our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like and what we are like now. I try and keep those things in balance. The first few times I told my story, I got about as far as 20 years old and my time was up. You know, I didn't mean to do a drunkologue, but there it was, because I was just discovering all this stuff. So I will try to hit all parts of that. And we're supposed to share our experience, strength, and hope, and I want to do that. And the other thing I remember is that part of the third step prayer that says, take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. We all have a story. We all have a narrative. We all have a, you know, what it was like and what got us here. So I'm just going to share mine. I like to sometimes, I'm going to try that tonight if it's okay with you, kind of, it's not really pre-planned, but use the steps as my guidepost. That way that helps me make sure I get some of the life and recovery stuff in. So, step one, which we heard read, we were admitted we were alcoholic, that our lives had become unmanageable. I was born in 1952 into a family of four. I have an older sister, 4 years older than me. And apparently, when I was a baby and brought home, she was really jealous. So the first couple of years of my life, I don't remember this because I didn't have an amygdala developed in my brain yet, but she tried to kill me a few times because she was jealous. So she wasn't allowed to be with me unattended for a while. And something switched at some point, and we became really close, and then we became absolute drinking buddies. She snuck me into bars when she was 16 and barely underage, and I was 4 years younger. It sounds crazy, but that's how it was, and we made each other laugh. We were both born with a huge tolerance for alcohol from the get-go, which seemed great. Going into it turns out to be one of those curses that turns on you later on. But so something happened pretty early on in my life when I was, I think, 6 years old, six or seven. And my family lived way out on the North Shore of Long Island before it was developed, and it was perfect for a young boy. I had a black lab dog, I had a bicycle, I had friends, we went to the beach every day, it was great. And my dad was a teacher, and he got a much better job in the suburbs of New York City. And when he told me about it, I wasn't happy. I actually pitched a fit. And he had, apparently, I learned later, had just told my mother, who had threatened to divorce him because she didn't want to move either to those, you know, crowded, highfalutin suburbs. And so he was already, you know, kind of peeved when he told me the news. And one of two times in my life that he actually spanked me. It wasn't a beating, but it was a hard spanking. And being a sensitive young guy, I took that to heart. And that lesson I carried with me and still carry remnants of it with me, that it's really dangerous to let people know when you're unhappy with something, when you're angry with something, because bad things happen to you from people that you love and trust. And so I had been reading a picture book about Stoics, so I decided to become a Stoic. And Stoics don't show emotions. They try to not have emotions. And where I got that idea, I don't know, but I really doggedly followed that. And the main emotion I would not let myself admit to, though other people suspected or saw it was there, was anger. I was terrified of anger. And then I found on my second, fourth and fifth step, more insightful than my first one, though not more important, was that I adopted this belief, again from somewhere, and nobody did this to me. I'm nobody's victim. I'm really not. But I decided that I'm really all alone and I'm not enough. But since I'm all alone, I can't let anyone know who I really am, including me. I didn't want to know who I really was. I knew who I thought I should be, supposed to be, wanted to be. So I became kind of walled off being all alone. I have never been an atheist, but it turns out I later found out I was agnostic. Latin A means without, and gnosis means knowledge. I couldn't believe in anything I didn't think I intellectually understood. And since I don't know anybody personally who can intellectually understand God, I could go around church, I could go around religious people. It didn't make me gag, it didn't make me angry, but I couldn't really connect with it. I would be around it, but it couldn't really get to me. So I grew up not knowing and not really telling anybody most of the time what was really going on with me. And at age seven, my dad was mowing the lawn and asked me to go out or go in and open a can of beer and pour it in a Dixie cup, a little bit of it. He was a very cheap date. He would get drunk after like one drink. And so I brought him the beer because he was hot mowing the lawn, but I sipped some of it first and it tasted god-awful. But something about that carbonated effervescence, I can still remember, and this is a lot of years ago, obviously. I'm way older than seven. It went up into my brain, and I remember this sort of warm feeling coming over my brain. And I'm like, what is that? But I liked it. I didn't like the taste of the stuff, but I liked the warm feeling that I didn't understand. And I think I was genetically preloaded, honestly, to be prone toward being that 1 in 10 or 1 in 11 that come down the assembly line with a brain that's pre-programmed to really be available to fall in love with alcohol. And I did. I did not immediately, you know, hit the road, ride the rails, become a drinker. But I really count the beginning of my drinking, the beginning of my journey of powerlessness at age 13. When I was doing sports, I was doing things, but I was also drinking on weekends. Like I said, I could drink a lot more than my friends, and they were like, wow, man, like it was some good thing. So other things started happening, and this all really does tie into the first step, because here I am trying to exert powers I don't have and manage my own life all by myself. My family loved me. I loved them. I was kind of the MC of the family relations were often tense between my parents, but I was the funny guy at the dinner table. I was the youngest, but I was like the MC, the handler, that everybody could talk to me. My mother, who my father and sister were afraid of because she could go like stone cold and freeze you, I developed that knack. And one time I remember sitting in a room with her, and she started giving me the silent treatment. I just smiled at her and I said, "You go a week, I'm going two. You go a month, I'm going a quarter. You go a quarter, I'm going a year." And she looked at me and she blinked and she believed me. So I never had trouble with her after that. I'm like, what is that? Vanquishing your mother by saying I can outduel you in the silent treatment? I didn't intend to do any of this stuff. It's just what came to mind living by myself in my own little bunker, thinking I had to, control my life. And also, people would tell me, yeah, you're really smart, you're really intelligent, like my parents, like teachers. And I didn't see that as a gift or anything. I saw it as like a crushing burden. Yet at the same time, part of me wanted to hear it, but a bigger part of me was terrified of it. So I became like a classic underachiever who could throw a flurry of activity at the last minute and save myself. Always like two steps ahead of the posse. And in school, I started out in honors classes and a couple of AP classes. By the time I graduated high school, I was in regular classes, and I've often said if I'd gone another year, I would have been in remedial classes because I was my drinking and drugging. I will mention that other drugs entered my life. I graduated high school in 1969 to kind of date and timestamp it. There was all kinds of stuff around, and I tried most of it. The one thing I never cared for or tried was things that made you go slower, like barbiturates and opium and heroin. And I found stimulants and alcohol were wonderful because I could then, a friend of mine who got into recovery before me and owned a bar, perfect. Oh, I'd go visit him on vacation. We could go for 3 or 4 days partying and other people would fall out and we wouldn't. So here I am all alone, classic underachiever, trying to... I got this idea, and this was later in my life, watching Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns, the Man with No Name. That I really aspired to that. I wanted to connect, but I really wanted to be alone. I wanted to not need anybody. But I was also doing stuff like going to college, and then succeeding at the last minute. I've got a degree in geology, which I declared halfway through my junior year when the dean said, if you don't declare a major, we're going to suspend you. And I got into grad school and got a master's in geology. Then I went to work for an oil company in Texas, went to law school at night, got that degree. And then drinking was just becoming more and more and more part of my life. I was the work hard, play hard guy. So trying to find something to connect with, and where it ended up in terms of the first step is at age 37, a couple years before, I had my first panic attack walking into a courthouse in Galveston, Texas, and had a panic attack over a routine hearing. It wasn't even a trial. I was a trial lawyer, and I couldn't go in there. And then driving back up to Houston, where I lived, I realized I can't do this. I can't practice law and drink. And I made the classic alcoholic choice. I dissolved my law practice and began giving my cases away. And then began sort of toward the end of my spiral downward. Had found somebody I got engaged to. I met her on a drunken flight from Washington, D.C. back to Texas. We met on the plane, shared a few drinks, made a date for New Year's Eve a week later, got arrested for DUI on the way between Houston and San Antonio. Our first date, I got my phone call at 2 a.m, called her up, and she drove out to this town and bailed me out of jail. And after that, it was just like we were tight. So great first date. She wore a little black dress that the guards really appreciated. Just craziness. But I never knew any of this stuff was crazy. It just seem normal, and yeah, I'm drinking, I got to cut back, I got to go a little hard. But at age 37, my family intervened on me, and gently enough that I didn't blow them off, but I was pretty unhappy at this point, being unemployable in San Antonio with my fiance. And so I moved back in, not a triumphant return, to my dad's house in New York in the middle of the summer, a 2.5 or 3 day Greyhound bus trip. And for some reason, I decided to not drink going home. So I was really in full blown withdrawal when I hit the New York City bus terminal, Port Authority, on like the hottest day of the summer, sweating out gallons of vodka. And then my dad was gracious, took me back in. And then the next day he broke the news to me, son, I want you to stop drinking. I was like, okay. So the next day I drank half his liquor cabinet and put water in, and that got found out. And he said, I'm serious, and you need to go to AA. And I found a friend, another guy who they visited their wives. My mother was in a nursing home at this point with dementia. And so I started going to AA, the Hartsdale-Arsley group up in New York, which was a group Bill Wilson had gone to in the 40s when he wanted to get away from the city. He would get in his roadster or whatever it was and drive up. And I began living a lie. I began pretending to be sober, but where I'd once been a geologist for Shell Oil Company, I got a job pumping gas in a Shell Oil station on Central Avenue in Yonkers, and with my keen mind, the owners within a week decided to fire the manager and promote me to manager so I could drink through the day out of room temperature vodka out of a Sprite can, pour oil and gas on myself enough to cover the fumes, and go to an AA meeting at night and pretend not to drink. And I did that for a year and a half to 2 years. Even forgot to have a phony relapse and got caught in having a phony one-year birthday. And my sister flew in from out of town in this darkened church basement, 200 people there, carried a cupcake with one lighted candle up to the front. That, you would think, would be my absolute bottom. Of living this lie. But it wasn't quite. That was the point where after that, I just said, the hell with it, and I began not pretending too much anymore. I went to work, I came home, and I drank through the night. Well, my father went away on a vacation. I think he kind of knew, pretended not to know what was going on. It was killing him. And when he did that, I drove all over Westchester County, bought all the vodka I could find in each store, a couple of half gallons, didn't want to be obvious, couldn't even hold my hand out without shaking to get the change, and I'd just throw the change in the bag and hold up for a final 10 to 12 days of drinking around the clock. And I couldn't go more than an hour without waking up and having to drink, because that's how my body was telling me how bad it was going to be. And somehow, this is where I always say the first step took me. I didn't take it. I was alive. I was rattling around this house with two or three TVs going. And a TV evangelist actually was on. It must have been a Sunday morning. Robert Schuller from the Crystal Cathedral. And weirdly, he seemed to come out of the TV and say, "This is for you. I know you're alone and miserable and drinking and drugging." And I was like, "He can see me." But I listened to him, and he said, "There's hope, there's help." And I went back upstairs, and I think soon after that, I lost track of time, I was sitting on the top of the staircase, and I just said, "I can't do this anymore, and I don't know how not to." And something happened, and that was my last drink. My dad came home like 2 days later, and I was in wretched shape, and he helped get me into a detox the day after, and I was at the admission desk, you know, trying to hold a pen to sign papers, and I went into full-blown DTs, and they called the code and took me upstairs. And they recommended, after I came to about 2 or 3 days later and went to treatment — I'd never been to Georgia, I came down here to treatment — and that's really how I got into AA. So you know, I can't do it and not, I don't know how to not do it is really the first step. And there's so much grace in there because by all, you know, logic, rational analysis, justice, I could have been and should have been dead. And a lot of us die from this first before that moment happens. But it happened for me, and that was grace. So came to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, I've already told you, I found out later I was agnostic. And I always thought I was this easygoing, open-minded guy. And it turns out I was incredibly closed-minded. I didn't believe in anything that I didn't think I already knew. And so it turns out later on I realized, and you know, I can't quote anything out of the book, but I was intensely spiritually seeking and thirsty my whole life. I just hooked up with the wrong higher power. Self-will, my wits, my willpower, and alcohol and drugs. And every time I would give up a drug, the alcohol would go up. And then I would give up another drug and the alcohol would go up. In the end, it was just alcohol. I'm very wary of other drugs because for me, they're gateways to the one that's going to get me. Some of you may have heard the haiku, and it is haiku because it's 17 syllables. It's really a synopsis of what I just described to you in more words. A man takes a drink, then a drink takes a drink, then the drink takes the man. That's what happened to me. And probably that's what happens in its own way to most of us. So, but some things alcohol did for me. It didn't start out bad. It didn't start out only because I had a tolerance for it. That warm feeling I had at age 7, it made me feel more comfortable in my own skin. It gave me a feeling of more completeness and ability to do things that ordinarily I didn't believe I could do. And, you know, that effect, I'm not saying it was all delusional the whole time, but that also turning to that all the time stopped me from actually developing other ways of getting that feeling, many of which have made recovery and sobriety so interesting. What starts out as not drinking, I believe, for me, through the process of the steps, and I supplemented it with some therapy, and now I am a part-time therapist. I believe in therapy. I don't believe you have to have it to get sober, but I believe it helped me in some additional ways to 12-step recovery. But the 12 steps, they're not therapy, but they sure as hell are therapeutic, that I began to develop some ability to not drink anymore, but live sober. But not drinking is always right at the core of living sober. But something tips it over. In my opinion, steps 6 and 7 are the real fulcrum for that, and I'll get to that in a minute. So another thing that was really important for me, though I'd never been an atheist, was in Bill's story where Bill's giving him the razzmatazz about, oh, you got religion, and he starts attacking religion. Evie just says, well, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And Bill said it was like stepping out from behind an icy intellectual mountain. That was me. Like, I don't have to create God. I don't have to find and capture God like a butterfly in a jar. I just can start with my own conception of God. And I started, like a lot of us do, with God is about love and support and wholeness. That's all I needed. That was enough of a mustard seed to grow. And I can't draw you a picture of God, but I have my own relationship with a power greater than myself who I give the name God. And it's still deepening and growing, another thing that makes living sober so interesting and rewarding. Because that was the missing piece. When I have that, not holier than anybody, not specially, you know, not sanctimonious, none of that, but when I feel connected in that way, then I can truly take the risk of being open and vulnerable and honest and authentic with you, and then let you do that back with me. I can now actually stand there and take a compliment without having to joke it away, explain it away, or see it as, uh-oh, more of that, oh, you're smart, oh, a burden, a compliment, oh, I can't live up to that. I'm not always waiting for other shoes to drop. I still love chapter 4 of the Big Book, We Agnostics. That's one of the most important chapters to me. And I kind of like, for those who've either been around a while or been introduced to kind of old school Joe and Charlie's Big Book study, the tapes that float around. I forget which one it was who said which Joe, which Charlie. Step one is the problem, step two is the solution, and the other steps are how I get the solution in my life. That's kind of how it is for me. Step two is still really important to me. It's like water falling on the ground and then it percolates down into the water table. It keeps me going. That and it was the beginning of an actual relationship. So now step three, oh boy, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I had made so many decisions, dropping out of my first college and hitchhiking all the way across the country, and then, you know, wandering around the West Coast and, you know, drinking and drugging and searching and seeking. I have developed some compassion for myself. Now, it's not an excuse or an alibi. I was given what I thought, what I believe, how my brain worked, and how it had been hijacked by alcohol and drugs, really. I was doing the best I could do. And I don't have to, you know, be that guy in a meeting who says, oh, I was just a worthless puke of a drunk. I was a human being trying to find a way out and didn't know there was a way out and didn't even know I needed a way out. So that decision, one of the most important ways I did step three, and it was painful at the time. It was in my first month of recovery. I was in a treatment center. They had an AA meeting on Sundays down in the cafeteria. And a lot of people came to this. It was in Decatur, and they came from all over. And I'd been ducking and hiding, and they finally nailed me to go up to the podium and read how it works. And they had a microphone that was really, you could hear every creaking nail. And I sounded like a sheep on helium because I was so toxic, and I had gross tremors, and I was riddled with anxiety. And everything in me wanted to find either run or pretend to have a heart attack or something. But I hung in there and I read it, and it took a really long time. And I could look out at the audience and see some people looking like they were looking at a train wreck and other people looking encouraging. And when I finally finished hyperventilating and slunk to my seat, a couple of guys just patted me on the arm and said, really good job. That was step three. I'm like, I've just been wandering around upstairs asking people, what is step three? Keep coming back. What is step three? Don't drink and go to a meeting. And thinking they were messing with me. They weren't giving me the answer. But I kind of knew, oh, hanging in there and doing something that's the next right thing, because I agreed to come to this group and they asked me, that was step three. So inventories, you know, I tried writing. I tried the Russian novel approach. And then I said, okay, I tried everything else and I went back to the four columns. And didn't think I had any resentments until I started writing names down, and then I couldn't stop writing. I was amazed at how many people, places, things, I mean, reams of paper. And then moving, you know, column two is easy. I knew what they had done to me. Column three, what's in here? I don't know what's in here. And I looked, and then column four, what was my part? That was baffling, but I began to see, somebody told me, what were you doing or thinking before, during, and after each of these resentments that played some role in it? And that made it not easy to swallow, but more understandable, that I found out every single item in my resentment list had self-centered fear and emotional insecurity, and also had expectations of others that they should do certain things for me. And they never did as much or sustained what I wanted. So I could never be satisfied. And I was always afraid and alone and always insecure. And if the program stopped there, I mean, I would have to drink or just grind my teeth into dust and live a horrible life. But then I ran into step five. And again, my first one was not the most insightful one, but it's the one where it was my first true feeling of a connection with God. Because when I went into that room, and they wanted me to discharge me from the treatment center on a Friday because I was done and the insurance wasn't going to pay anymore. But my lawyer came out and I browbeat them into letting me stay till Sunday so I could do my fifth step. And I walked in that room in the hospital with my sponsor and came out a few hours later. And two very savvy psych nurses, not easily suckered, took a look at me and said, "You've changed." And it was the first time I'd ever really opened up to another person, another man. And I still can remember it. So five was incredible. And then entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Like a bunch of people, I tried to rebuild my own personality, rebuild myself in a better image. Not knowing I was doing that, but tried self-help and self-correction. And what did it for me was when there was this woman I knew who I was friends with. She was funny, she was nice, she was kind to me. She was having a bad day and I didn't know. I saw her and she said something and I said something sarcastic back to her. And there was no one else around and I could see the pain in her eyes. And I just knew I did that. So the first character defect I decided to work on was sarcasm. And in step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. The way I did it was I didn't say much for a while. Somebody had told me at a Reader's Digest of all places, well, there's three things. Ask yourself before you say anything. Is it true? Is it necessary? Is it kind? Truth, I always thought, was a good starting point. Then it was like a tapestry that you could then weave on to make and embellish a story. Is it necessary? Hardly ever, because things I quote as facts are actually my opinions based on my closed-minded guesses at things, not experiential wisdom. And I think I've always been and wanted to be a kind person and have that in me. But sarcasm is taking a sense of humor and turning it into a weapon and a shield. And remember, I can't admit I'm angry, but I can kiddingly dig you. That's the spear. And then when you come back at me, that's the shield. I was just kidding. But I couldn't do that with her. And so that was my motivation. I really began trying to change that. And I'm still 6 and 7 is recalibration. Rusty Jones has called it, you know, cutting your fingernails and they grow back. But that doesn't freak me out anymore because there's a solution. And I claim spiritual progress, not perfection. I don't have to be perfect. There's no such thing. I think perfection is a bad idea that doesn't actually exist. So step 8 is an interesting step. A lot of us, oh yeah, recopy your 4 steps, say a prayer, yeah, I'm willing. That's the step where I really saw how hard-hearted I'd always been. This nice, easygoing guy, good sense of humor, yeah, a little irony or sarcasm, but, you know, I never forgot a slight. And slights were like, if you love me, but not enough. That was hard for me to see. But then step 9 happened, which is where I really began to take responsibility for myself with other people. All this inner work now reconnects with other people. And just recently, last week, I talked to somebody who found me on the internet, a wife of my best friend when I was an oil and gas geologist. And I connected with him and then been invited to dinner and really liked them as a couple. And then they had their first child and they asked me to be a godfather. And I agreed. And the last time I saw her was when she was 2 years old in the early 1980s. And here's this, you know, this woman connecting with me. And we had a great conversation. Near the end of it, I said, I can't think of anything I've done to hurt you, but do we have any unfinished business? Because I'd really like to clear up anything there is, because you were wonderful and you still are, and I want to do that. And she said, no, we knew you went through some hard times sometimes, but with us, you were always wonderful, generous, funny. She told me about a time I'd loaned them some money because my friend had lost his wedding ring and they didn't have them. I didn't remember this stuff. And then she said, by the way, Whitney, my goddaughter, who I haven't seen for 38 years, is probably going to call you because we always talk about Uncle Paul and how cool and funny he is, and she's going to want to talk to him. Like, oh my God. So, you know, I had even forgotten about keeping them on my amends list, but it kind of came to me. And I'm glad I asked. And I wasn't like cringing. I wasn't assuming. I just said, is there anything that I've done? And I never would have been able to do that before. Step 10 is like my go-to step. 10 to me is, I've heard it described as 4 through 9 in the present tense. It's kind of a ring. So I heard a guy say, and I adopted it a long time ago, I heard it, that my basic working fuel, which used to be self-will, self-centered fear, wits and willpower, and alcohol, is now 10, 6, 7, 11, and the last part of 12. Try and practice these principles in all my affairs. So, that step 10, at first, was catching myself doing something wrong. Another character defect. There it is again. Oh, my God. Originally, it read to me like, because you're going to constantly do stuff wrong, you're going to have to constantly go make amends to people. Maybe it starts out like that for other people, not just me. But I actually found that I can take responsibility for what I've done and not feel like I wish the earth would open up and swallow me, or like I have to attack the person who's put me in this position of having to apologize to them. Maybe some of you can relate to some of these reactions. They're not rational. They're emotional reactions when I don't have a program of action, a way of living to be able to be a human among humans. Step 11, the relationship really started with step 1. Step 1 made me available to have a relationship with a power greater than myself. Step 2 was like the first explicit brick in that relationship, but 11 deepens it. And I do pray. I do meditate. I do all those things, and again, there's no perfection in it. I just do them, and they tend to get more wired into my brain. They're not as hard anymore, and I don't have to meet any standards. I just do it because they help me, and I like them. They're nourishing. And then step 12. Early on, I was sort of unavailable to be in relationships other than AA friendships. And I ended up doing a lot of service work. I got elected GSR in my first home group. Because it turned out, they told me later, they voted for me because they thought I was the sickest person and needed it the most. I thought it was because I was the most competent and best candidate. No, like, you were the sickest one in the room. But we knew you were so driven. One of my nicknames was Captain Recovery. You know, do 90 in 90s. I did 270 in 90s. Get a sponsor, I tried having four. You know, that was me, Captain Recovery. I was fun to be around. And then I became a DCM, and then I was the area DCM, and just a lot of service work, because that's what I put myself into. And also, I do step 12 now by really trying to actively be with and listen to people, to label my opinions as opinions, to not try and talk people into getting sober, not trying to be the cleverest or funniest or most profound in my sharing, you know, not sharing for the balcony, but sharing my experience, strength, and hope. And another way I do step 12 is by trying to practice the traditions. I did tradition studies for a while, finding out how much of what I think are opinions that have value to me and maybe to others, but they're not facts. I don't have to correct people's perceptions. I can just offer my opinions. I value them, but other people don't have to for me to be okay. Page 124 and 125 in step 12 is some of my favorite parts of the literature, so I'll read that with your indulgence. Still more wonderful is the feeling that we do not have to be especially distinguished among our fellows in order to be useful and profoundly happy. Not many of us can be leaders of prominence, nor do we wish to be. And this is where it gets even better. Service gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help. The knowledge that at home or in the world outside, we're partners in a common effort. The well-understood fact that in God's sight, all human beings are important. The proof that love freely given surely brings a full return, the certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons, the surety that we need no longer be square pegs in round holes but can fit in and belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitute. Then these next words are my working definition of a sober man in recovery and a human being. True ambition is not what we thought it was. True ambition, my time's up, but I'm going to finish it. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. And so for me, the steps are like this ring. I often enter in step 10 when I notice something's up with me or around me and I'm responding to it. And then I can do these things and then get back to this place, take this freaked out brain, calm it down, feel connected, and be able to go back to living in step 12. And I have a way to get there all the time. So I'm incredibly grateful. I have a wonderful family. I have a marriage, which I'd never been able to have when I was drinking. I was a commitment phobe. I have two wonderful stepdaughters, five wonderful grandchildren, and a goddaughter who I'm going to meet and haven't seen in 38 years. But I get to, I work in a hospital helping people who help people. I work as a therapist helping people. I got to be a professor where I got my last degree. And all of it, it's not about achieving so people see how good I am. It's about allowing myself to be aware of and be put in positions where I can give and receive. So giving and receiving, love and service, is what really I live for now. I don't live for the thrill. I don't live for the chemical relief. I don't live for being the first, the smartest, the best, any of that. And I can, whatever light I have, I can let it shine and not cover it over with a bushel basket anymore, like an old girlfriend once told me. You always hide your light under a bushel. I looked at her like, yeah, time to leave. So anyway, I hope there's been something of value and use and interest to you in this, and I really appreciate a chance to put myself out there to you. So thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for taking us full circle, showing us how the steps can be integrated into our lives in every aspect. I admire that about you. I won't go on and make you blush, but... How's everybody else feeling?
Too late. Damn it.
Man has got recovery, and he shares recovery, and he works with so many people, not just in the meetings. I don't know how many people he's helped, but it's probably countless. Well, thanks again, Paul. Okay, well, next week we have Barry C. from the Let Go and Let God group of Richmond, Virginia. She incidentally picked her white chip up at NAVA, I think at the 545 group, because she had recently visited the 545 How It Works Zoom group, was reminiscing and had a really super share. And she's a health professional. She's involved in recovery professionally. She got sober 93 at NAVA, and her name's Barry C. We're really grateful that she's willing to speak to us next week.
I'm gone away. I never go. Only thing I own in a paper sack. I'm all alone, and I'm lonesome day and night. I need someone's hand carry me when I'm tired. I can't stay here no more. That mean old bartender just showed me the door. Somewhere, somehow, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway. Thank you. I won't have to fight it no more. Somehow, someway, I'll win my fight someday. And we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway.